People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. A UBC group has identified public land in communities across BC it says could be a good fit for affordable housing. They've put all of this info into an interactive map that anyone can visit online. The BC Public Lands Map launched June 30th. On it, there are thousands of individual parcels identified and scored based on how suitable they would be for housing. There are 54 parcels that score very high around Nanaimo, and around 170 in the capital region, with several hundred in the lower mainland. For each parcel, you can see the ownership, the current use, the neighborhood density, scores for how close the parcel is to different amenities, and more. I spoke with a member of the team behind the project about how he hopes the map can lead to more affordable housing in BC.
My name is Craig Jones. I am the Associate Director of the Housing Assessment Resource Tools Project at UBC.
And your team have designed an interactive map of public lands in BC scored for their housing potential. What did you learn doing that?
We learned a lot going through that process. So fundamentally, what the BC Public Lands Map does is it brings together public lands, which are identified and visible through the BC parcel map fabric. And you can find these parcels, you can see what high levels of government ownership there is. But with that parcel map BC fabric, it was hard to get any information on the characteristics of those parcels. And so what we did is we then joined that with data from BC assessment on the property characteristics to then identify, okay, well, are these parcels sitting vacant or are they underused, in that the value of the structure on the parcel is 20% or less than 20% of the value of the land. So there's some kind of value gap there. We learned a bunch about the BC assessment data, about property valuation, about just how many vacant and underused parcels there are under public ownership throughout BC. And then from there, that's really the backbone of the whole project, bringing these two large data sets together to speak to each other, because as far as I know, they haven't really been brought together before. And then we just layered on a whole bunch of other variables, like proximity to roads and electrical grid and water mains, the slope of the parcel, whether or not they're close to amenities like grocery stores or places of work, public transportation, all those kind of things, brought them all together and then put it out for the public.
And as you say, this is a public tool. Anyone can go online, and whether you live in Nanaimo or Courtney or Victoria or Vancouver or wherever, you can drag it around, see which parcels score high on the map in your community. And that's all well and good, and that's really fun. But who do you intend to use this tool and maybe say, hey, wait, we have the power to do something with it?
Yeah, I mean, basically everyone who is motivated, has the ability, has an interest in seeing the supply of non-market affordable housing in British Columbia increase. There's been a lot of talk about the housing crisis and the need for overall supply in order to get affordability back on track in the province. There's also been a lot of discussion around in some places where you might be surprised, such as Scotiabank put out a report a few years ago looking at this problem and agreed with many other organizations that have been calling for an increase in the share of non-market housing in Canada. It wasn't that long ago that the proportion of housing starts in Canada that were social housing was pretty large, right? You go back to the 1960s, 70s, 80s, there's a pretty good percentage of starts and dwellings that are for social housing. And then we hit the 1990s, things pretty much go off a cliff, and then we don't we see some, but as a proportion of new starts, we just don't see much. And so now where we are in Canada is that it's hard to say exact numbers, but about 5% of Canada's housing stock is, social affordable. That is half the average for OECD countries, Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. It's about half of those other countries that Canada is a member of the OECD. And so in order to get to that average, that would basically require a doubling of the non-market social affordable housing stock in Canada, which lots of different organizations have called for. And that just gets us back up to that average. And in order to achieve that, we need something in the order of, 25 in British Columbia to, well, actually in Canada, we would need about 24% of all new housing starts to be social affordable housing, which is, we are way off from that. And in British Columbia, it's estimated that we would need about 25,000 new social affordable housing dwellings in BC every single year. Right now, we are quite a bit less than that. And so this is the that's that that's the challenge. So anybody in BC, I don't care if you are a community member, in government, in a nonprofit builder, for-profit builder, an association member, First Nation, everybody, it's out there to use to encourage the expansion of that needed supply.
And you've talked a little bit so far about how you gave each of these parcels a score. For example, I'm speaking to you from Nanaimo, where you have identified 54 parcels with a very high score. What factors does it take to get a very high score? What does that mean?
Something like 25 different variables. This it's 100 points, and the score was developed in partnership with our advisory committee, which had representatives from government, that's at the provincial level, regional level. We had some local level inputs. We also involved lots of different organizations and heard from them. What's important? What matters the most to be part of this scoring regime? And then we also ran those numbers by development consultants too, to say, look, do these numbers make sense? Is this a scoring system that you would agree with? And they checked that out and generally agreed with what we found. And so what are those sort of key characteristics? Well, the first one is that, well, is it vacant? And if so, that's a big one, right? That 25 points is basically if the land is currently sitting vacant. If it's underutilized, I believe that's about 15 points. So there's like a 10-point premium on it sitting vacant. So that's the biggest chunk, single chunk. Then we've got, okay, how well serviced is it? How close to roads, electrical grid, water mains? Like, how difficult would it be to build there? And that's where we build in this slope. We actually calculated an average slope for almost the entire province that's, within a municipal boundary. Then we add in access to the things like I mentioned before, being close to jobs, childcare, grocery stores, community centers, the things that people in maybe non-market affordable housing would really benefit from, especially if they don't have access to a car. And we also labeled it layered in some additional features such as natural hazards and riparian zones, that kind of stuff. What's the sort of natural environment around? So what is the nearby wildfire risk? What's the relative flood risk? And is it close to any natural bodies of water, such as streams, that building nearby would be not a great idea?
Okay, so let's say I'm looking at the map. I see, ooh, here are some parcels that are very highly scoring. That would be a great place to put some kind of public non-market housing. What happens next? What are the barriers to that actually coming to be?
I mean, the barriers are a multitude. I actually think that, building non-market housing is one of the hardest things that anyone can set out to do. I have so much respect for the folks that are out there who, don't make a lot of money doing this, but are really mission-driven to develop and run affordable housing for the people who need it. So, this is where we this is when we provided this tool, the vision for providing this tool is to say, look, we're not the development experts here. I can't tell you for sure that any of those 50 parcels that are identified as high scoring are going to work. But what I can do is I can save you a huge amount of time identifying where those parcels are. And then from that point, if you have that development expertise, if you've done a project before, if you're a development consultant, if you're a municipality, if you're in senior government and you know you want to build some kind of project, this cuts out, I think, a lot of time in identifying, okay, where's that what's called like lowest hanging fruit? Where are the easiest sites that are there? The barriers that could exist are just voluminous, right? We've done our best to include flags for, has there ever been a environmental remediation tag? We've included that for the parcels where that's available. We've included what the current use is when possible, and also what the zoning is at that time to give people a sense of like, well, this one, its current use is maybe it's vacant, but it's under a utilities use, so perhaps it's a works yard or public, something for trucks to be parked on or something along those lines. And also, it's currently zoned as industrial, so maybe that's not going to be great. But there could be other parcels in which, well, I don't want to look at industrial zone. I want to look at residential. I want to look at residential use. And we see a lot of those. Other barriers that could exist are, what is the site soil, right? We couldn't get at that. Is the surface permeable? Is it contaminated? Will it hold up to, will it allow for easy construction of a foundation? Because underneath the ground, there are huge, that's where when you start digging, you start uncovering new challenges. Other barriers could be that, is it, we really think around that the ideal structure for non-market multifamily housing is about six stories, right? And so we've done our best to build in a something of a development index. And so for what we did is for every single city block in British Columbia, so every single city block in Nanaimo, we calculate using 2021 census data the units per acre, the sort of the dwelling density of every single city block, and we apply it to each city block. Then what we do from there is for each city block, we take a look at the surrounding area and calculate the median density, and then within that area as well, which is a kilometer, we calculate the highest density. And so we offer three different scenarios in which we're saying, look, if you want to be absolutely consistent with this particular city block, this is how many units you can get. If you want to be more consistent with the area, this is how many units you may be able to get on this site. And if you really want to push the envelope, here's what the highest density in your area relevant, that's relevant for your parcel can be built on. So we are, I there's always a reason why something a project can't go ahead, and we're really trying to go in the other direction of saying, okay, well, what are the opportunities? How can we be as expansive with opportunities as we can with this project?
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Craig Jones, Associate Director of the Housing Assessment Resource Tools Project at UBC. The team has put together an interactive map of publicly owned land across the province. The map scores parcels of land based on how suitable they would be for affordable housing. You can find the map online at ubc.ca/bcplm. Are decision makers at various levels, whether that's councillors or people who work at housing authorities or BC Housing or provincial politicians, are they aware of this tool? And if so, how are they using it?
So the tool has only been available for about 3 weeks. We promoted this tool as much as we could. So our hope is that they are aware of this tool, and we have had interactions and meetings with folks who are out there in some of those levels of responsibility who are starting to wrap their head around, okay, what does this mean? What can we do with this? We've had a few requests for like, well, could you, we want to look at some particular parcels. We don't want to look at everything. We'd like to be able to really focus in on just a handful. Could you provide us with that kind of an output? So we can really focus in and then go from there. And then they can do their due diligence. They can do their research with their expertise to find out, okay, what are the best sites? So right now we're hearing from folks who are out there, hearing from the sector. We'll be producing some case studies of how people have been using it since launch, and then putting that out for people to see. But yeah, my hope is that this continues to get wide use and that more people hear about it and engage with it.
So if the pitch is that you have identified public land that is available that could be good for some kind of public housing, what would you say is the best way to maybe structure that housing to thread the needle of it can actually get built, but also the housing that does get built is affordable and stays affordable for generations to come?
Yeah, so there's a lot of challenges that are out there right now. Costs are up, construction costs are way up. There's a lot going on right now that's making it challenging to build. But what our research has shown, and other research out there has shown, is that access to land is a prerequisite. For a lot of the societies that are looking to build and are going out there to get funding, or mortgages or loans to build, they have to have secure access to land in order to make that work. And we've done research across the country with nonprofit providers, and identification of land came through as like a really important something we could do that would really help with those efforts. And so identifying those opportunities. Then we've been arguing for quite a long time that providing, whoever the holder of that land is, whatever level of government that is, whether it be federal down to municipal or regional, providing access to that land at low or no cost can really help get these projects to pencil out, to be to make sense economically, so that the rents that are offered can be affordable and yet still cover the operating costs. So then where I come from is I'm a huge believer in the non-market, a non-profit housing sector in British Columbia. I think we're really lucky to have organizations like BC Housing, the Aboriginal Housing Management Association, the BC Nonprofit Housing Association, and just a myriad of other housing providers and societies that are doing incredible work. And so what I think that the best way to guarantee that these units remain affordable is to put them in the hands of societies and operators who are cost driven, who are, the rents are driven by the need to cover the cost of operating the building. That's how we really do see affordability delivered in the long term. And I really think that the cooperative housing sector is an excellent example of that in BC. That when you have co-ops, which did, were big in the 1980s and 1990s, received subsidies and also some grants to operate over time, the gap on what co-ops typically charge for their housing charges versus the market rental is huge. Even if it wasn't that different to begin with when they were first built, now because those dwellings are, or actually their societies are cost driven, they only need to charge their members, their residents, what is needed to maintain the building. And when you take out that like profit incentive, the savings are huge.
Is this public land map, is it being updated in real time and maintained over the long haul?
No, the short answer for that is no. This project was funded by the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, as what's called a demonstration initiative. So this is an idea that's sort of been bouncing around in my head for several years. It's like I've been aware that there are these, two sources of data in BC. They don't really speak together. I'm kind of like thinking about, okay, how could we bring this together to produce this resource? And so it was a one-time grant. We're in UBC. We are not really set up to charge any kind of subscription fees or, make money off of this. This is a straight up research project, so we don't have any revenue generation options for this. And so what our plan is to make the case for an annual update of this tool. And there's one main reason for that. And that's because the BC assessment role, the sort of like that BC assessment does of all the properties in the entire province, that is given a full update once per year. Usually it's done in July of each year, so there'll be one happening around now. And so that then every single parcel gets an update. And so that's a really good time. Once that data is fully collected and processed, it's a great time for us to then get another what we call a snapshot of the public land ownership that's out there. Because we can pull that pretty easy. That we could do on a regular basis, but it's the BC assessment property characteristics that only gets updated once per year. And so we plan on timing our updates with the release of new BC assessment data.
Do you have a hope or a way of measuring the impact of this public map?
I mean, so what we've been doing at Heart is we provide data tools to as many people as possible at zero cost. And so I can only speak to the work that we have done in the past, and particularly we've done, a housing need assessment dashboard, which shows core housing need by municipality across the entire country. And that's had huge uptick, right? We have municipalities across the country that make use of our data, make use of our dashboard in their housing needs reports, or at the very least make reference to it and the methodology. And so the value of that is it's in the millions of dollars if you calculate just how, this information is just available to anyone at like zero barrier. So because we're so early in on this process, we need to hear from stakeholders and people who are using it around how they're benefiting from it. But I have fairly modest goals for this. Like this is, it's like a it's four people spending about a year working on this. Not all of us working on it full time either, right? Doing we have other projects that we're working on at the same time. This is not our only thing that we do. To put this out for a fairly modest amount of money. It didn't cost like a huge amount of money to do, but it took a lot of time and effort to do it. And so I think that if this BC public lands map supports even just a few thousand units get built that wouldn't otherwise happen in BC, that's a huge win.
Craig Jones, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Craig Jones is Associate Director of the Housing Assessment Resource Tools Project at UBC. You can find the public land map we were talking about online at ubc.ca/BCPLM.
People First Radio and Media are Vancouver Island Mental Health Society education and awareness programs.
A team at the Canadian Centre on Substance Use and Addiction wants to make it easier for people who use cannabis to know how much THC they're taking in. The center has been working on an initiative to implement a standard unit of consumption for THC, sort of like the idea of a standard drink for alcohol. A Canadian standard drink when it comes to alcohol is a Canadian standard drink is 13.45 grams of pure alcohol, which works out to 1.5 ounces of a 40% liquor, or 341 milliliters of a 5% alcohol content beer, or 142 milliliters of 12% wine. The recommendation for a unit of THC is 2.5 milligrams. I reached out to the Canadian Centre on Substance Use and Addiction for more on the call for a standard THC unit.
My name is Shay Wood, and I'm a senior knowledge broker at the Canadian Centre on Substance Use and Addiction. And my work, I really lead a lot of the knowledge mobilization work on the cannabis file here at CCSA and also oversee much of our work related to youth prevention and health promotion.
And one of the files that you've been working on is the idea of a standard unit of consumption for cannabis in Canada. Can you tell me what that is all about?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to talk about a standard THC unit. I wonder, Joe, if it's okay if I give a little background info and context. It might be helpful for some of the listeners.
Please.
All right. So, I mean, I'm sure people will know cannabis comes from the cannabis plant. And actually, cannabis, the flower, the bud that comes from the plant contains more than 100 chemical compounds called cannabinoids. And one of the most well-known is THC. And that's delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol. There's other well-known cannabinoids as well, like CBD, cannabidiol. But we talk about THC a lot because it is that ingredient that makes people feel high when they consume cannabis. It's that primary psychoactive ingredient of cannabis. It's also researched for medical applications. So people probably know that in 2018, cannabis became legal in Canada for non-medical purposes. And at that time, really just a dried flower and some oils were available on the legal market. And then a year later, in 2019, the market expanded significantly, and there were a lot of different types of products available. So that includes edible products, concentrates, things like this. And so now cannabis can be used to create a wide variety of products available on our legal market. Like I said, edibles, beverages, things. So concentrates. When we talk about concentrates, we're talking about extracting those cannabinoids out of the cannabis plant and concentrating them in a different format. So those are available, vapes, all of this stuff available on the legal market now and can be consumed in different ways. So all of that to say, just to give a little kind of that front loading around THC, because we're talking about a standard unit of THC, that the concentration of THC found in cannabis has really increased over time. And compared to some of the products we had, 25 years ago and beyond, these modern cannabis products contain substantially higher levels of THC. So we kind of talk about them as higher potency products. Worth mentioning that many people use cannabis occasionally without experiencing any significant problems related to cannabis use. But research does show that higher amounts of THC exposure increases the risk of experiencing certain harms or adverse experiences. So, frequent or higher potency product use, particularly when it's used, initiated maybe at a younger age or used over a long period of time, it's been associated with different risks for, different health conditions like experiencing symptoms of psychosis, cardiovascular issues. Cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, which is a condition involving stomach pain and sort of cyclical vomiting, and also developing a cannabis use disorder or addiction to cannabis. So just want to give some context there that, those risks are associated with cannabis use, especially large amounts of THC use. And but the risk can vary significantly depending on lots of factors like the amount used, frequency, or how often it's used, and the method of consumption, or even individual vulnerability factors like family history, medical history, history of mental health conditions. So just wanted to let you know that because really the main point is that understanding exposure to THC is really important. And it's both important in research, so like trying to investigate and determine how much THC is really related to certain health outcomes, but also really important for individuals using cannabis so that they can make decisions about how much THC they want to consume. And because we have this diverse range of cannabis products available now, that diversity makes it kind of difficult to communicate and measure THC. Some products, they measure it in terms of concentration. So they communicate THC as a percentage, some milligrams or milligrams per gram. So in that kind of context of diversity of products and really the importance of understanding THC exposure, that's sort of where a concept of a standard THC unit emerged from and is important within that context.
Maybe one of the easier ways into this conversation for people might be comparing and contrasting the situation to alcohol, where there's this idea of a standard drink. You have a sense that maybe a can of beer equals a certain sized glass of wine equals an ounce and a half of some kind of hard liquor. How would you explain the situation, the analogous situation with cannabis in that context of like a standard drink? What is the standard drink of cannabis?
Great question. And in a way, it is like a standard drink for alcohol. So really, when we're thinking about a standard THC unit, sort of the definition, like the standard drink, is a pretty simple and straightforward concept. It's a set amount of THC measured in milligrams applied across all cannabis products and methods of use. So in Canada, for THC, that has been recommended at 2.5 milligrams. And again, that purpose is to provide a practical and a standardized metric for measuring and communicating THC across those different product formats. And so that's what a standard unit of THC is. It's a unit of measurement. And from there, it has different uses. So similar to a standard drink for alcohol, a standard drink is also used in measurement. It's a standard amount, a set amount of pure ethanol or alcohol. So in Canada, that's 13.45 grams of ethanol or pure alcohol. And just like you said, a standard drink, so that amount of pure alcohol, that psychoactive ingredient, like we're talking about THC as a psychoactive ingredient, that amount of alcohol is consistent across these different products, even when the products look really different. And so I think that that's sometimes, a good way to start to think about it for people who are just new to the concept of a standard THC unit. Cannabis is a bit more complex for several reasons, one being that there's different ways to use it. So you can inhale the product and ingest it, so, eating or drinking. But similarly, it's a tool to understand exposure to the primary psychoactive ingredient across product formats. And now we've been using that quite for alcohol, actually quite effectively in research. So, we now understand the impacts of alcohol and their effects on health, and we can actually create risk thresholds for how much alcohol might increase your risk of experiencing certain outcomes. And, you can get that information in Canada's Guidance on Alcohol and Health. But the goal is to get there too with cannabis and with THC, to be more precise about what we can say about how much THC might contribute to certain outcomes or certain effects. And then, beyond research is really important, but beyond research, then people, individuals who want to use cannabis, like they do when they're kind of counting their drinks to see how much exposure they have to alcohol, how much alcohol they're taking in. That they're able to then use that unit to make decisions about how much THC they want to consume, especially if they're using different product formats. If I'm smoking dried cannabis one day, having a drink another day, or an edible, a standard THC unit would allow someone to have a better understanding, a deeper understanding of how much THC they're taking in across those different products.
Could you explain to me the difference between different methods of consuming cannabis, whether that's smoking, eating some kind of gummy, or having some kind of cannabis beverage? How do each of those impact how much THC you're taking in?
Yeah, really, really good question because we know that different methods of use have different qualities and they affect people differently. So when we are inhaling a product, we can feel the effects very quickly. So within a few seconds to a few minutes, we can feel the effects. And they usually are shorter in duration, in terms of how long it lasts. When we ingest cannabis products, we know they go into our digestive tract. They take longer to get into our bloodstream, to our brain. And so sometimes the effects are delayed. We might not feel the full effects of ingesting cannabis for a longer period of time. And sometimes the effects, depending, of course, on how much THC you're consuming across all methods of use, but sometimes of ingested products, the effects can last quite a bit longer. So I think it's really important. Actually, you lead into, I think, something that might be helpful to clarify because there are some common misconceptions, perhaps, around a standard THC unit that I think sometimes can be a barrier for us moving forward with it. And one of them is that some people think that when we establish a standard THC unit, it means that we're saying that it's going to be equivalent or the same effects across different products or methods of use. And of course, we're talking about applying it across all products or methods of use. But, you know, what someone experiences might not be the same. So just for an example, someone might experience different effects from using one standard unit through an edible as they would when they use one standard unit through smoking or vaping. Because again, we know that they have different qualities, they affect people differently. And some research does suggest that sort of the peak high might be similar across different product formats, although it might hit a bit differently in terms of its timing or its length. But there's still, you know, more work and research that needs to be done on that aspect. But actually, by having this common metric, we're not saying the experience of using one unit would be the same across all product formats, but having it allows us to actually do the research, examining and comparing the effects from different cannabis products and methods of use at comparable levels of THC. So again, it's a tool that we can use to understand what the similarities and differences might be across different product formats.
Could you speak to me about the specific number you've suggested for this standard unit, 2.5 milligrams? I've seen some research you've worked on that suggested regular cannabis users might look at that and say, that's really low. And that there might be, for example, in years past in other places, examples of a joint having more than 10 times that much. Could you talk to me about what that number means in context?
Yeah, absolutely. And as you mentioned, we've been working, we have at CCSA, we convene some working groups of different types of experts and people with lived experience of cannabis use who have been working on bringing together evidence and information to help inform the implementation of a standard THC unit in Canada. And one of those reports was around kind of the parameters for choosing what makes up that set amount of THC in the unit. Or, and I think there are definitely different parameters that you would use, and it would depend the weight that you put on the different parameters, really depends on the jurisdiction. So, for example, for comparing back to alcohol, different areas, different countries have different standard drinks, the amount of pure alcohol that's in their standard drink. And they've made that decision based on a lot of factors, historical factors, the types of, you know, we call it ecological data, but the types of products that are commonly used in their region, scientific or experimental data around how much intoxication is, how much, you know, that psychoactive ingredient leads to intoxication. For us, we looked at all different parameters that some of our colleagues internationally have used to identify a standard THC unit. Tom Freeman and Valentina Lorenzetti did a lot of work in this area, and they came up with some great parameters. And now we are looking at them within the Canadian context. And our context is pretty different from other places in the world because we have a federally legalized substance, so it's legal across our whole country, even though different provinces might make different regulations around cannabis. We have these diversity of product formats. We have all different types of cannabis users, right? We have people who have never used cannabis before who might be walking into a store for the first time. We have people who have been using cannabis for a very long time. We have older adults at the beginning of legalization. We saw actually older adults were kind of one of the age groups that were climbing the fastest. They've plateaued since, but so all different types of cannabis users. And we consider all those facts when we're trying to identify what the unit should be. Now, I think it's important personally to point out that the unit itself isn't as important as its application. So, you know, it could be 5 milligrams, it could be 2.5 milligrams. What's important is that it's a standard metric, a kind of, you know, a metric that's universal that we use across the different product formats, because then we can really have that comparability between products and we can have a consistent messaging around what a unit is. So definitely would encourage people to look at the parameters report that we put out at CCSA if they want to understand what goes into selecting that unit. One of the key features we said was some people might interpret a standard unit as a starting dose. And I think that that is maybe another misconception I could speak to, but if that's the way that people are interpreting it, then we wouldn't want that to be too high, that it might cause adverse effects. So maybe just on that point, Joe, before I move on, that the standard unit in itself isn't a recommended dose. Again, it's a unit of measurement, a measurement tool. It's not a dosing recommendation. So, it doesn't necessarily indicate how much THC a person should consume to achieve their desired effect, because that amount's going to be really different from person to person, depending on so many factors. Like, we know that people's frequency of use and their tolerance would affect how much they want to consume. We know that the kind of product composition, if it has other cannabinoids in it, there's a lot of things, biology, metabolism, so many things affect the way someone experiences a dose of cannabis. And so the THC unit can be used for people to make decisions about how much they want to take individually, but it's not necessarily a recommended dose for everyone that will have the same effects across everyone, because that's just impossible. And it might be used in lower risk guidance or in guiding kind of recommendations, but itself, again, a unit of measurement that we can use in different ways.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. I'm speaking with Shea Wood of the Canadian Center on Substance Use and Addiction. We're talking about the idea of a standard THC unit in Canada. What is the situation right now for people if they walk into the cannabis store and they're trying to navigate how potent various products are going to be? What are they seeing on the labels of the various things available? And how is it different from this idea of a standard unit?
Yeah, great question. We know that THC is being communicated on product labels and in different consumer kind of information that's available in retail spaces in very different ways. So, as I mentioned, the metrics themselves are different in terms of the percentage, that whether it's milligrams, whether it's milligrams per gram. And there's been some really good work done through the International Cannabis Policy Study led by David Hammond and his team. And they have really found that, in general, cannabis literacy is quite low in Canada, that a lot of consumers have difficulty understanding the kind of the potency or the strength of cannabis. And it's kind of led to people having trouble dosing themselves and sometimes experiencing adverse effects from using cannabis. And also, in some of these surveys, when people are asking what constitutes a high or a low dose, some people have a really hard time even identifying what constitutes a high or a low dose. So I would say generally there are certainly people who, especially people who might use cannabis more often or have a lot of experience with it, who know products and they know what's right for them. And they, if especially if they use one product type, they know what to look for on that label. But for a lot of people who are going in to access cannabis products on our legal market, they might not have that kind of awareness of what they should be selecting in terms of the products and how much of that product they should be taking. So I would say that this metric of a THC unit isn't meant to replace these other metrics. Some of them are really important, like knowing the percentage of THC in dried flower, for example. People are used to seeing that who use dried flower. They know what it means for them. But it's supposed to complement other ways of communicating THC. And again, especially for people who use different types of products, so they're really understanding how much THC they're using across these different product formats. I would say there's still work to do to identify the best way to educate people on a standard THC unit. Of course, them understanding the concept and what it means for them is essential when it comes to implementing this. So there's more work to do on understanding the best way to educate around it, and also how it would practically be implemented on labels across product formats. Because, as you kind of alluded to earlier, 2.5 milligrams of THC in one product might be easier to communicate than another product that might have, hundreds of units in it. So there's still work to do there, but what we can definitely see is there is a need to boost cannabis literacy in Canada.
We've been talking about the idea of a standard unit of consumption around THC. What about CBD? Where does that fit into this picture?
Yeah, CBD, as I mentioned, is another constituent of cannabis, and it is being it's a non kind of intoxicating cannabinoid that exists, but it is being researched for various different medical applications. So there are certainly some areas where it can be recommended or it's being included in different types of medications and prescriptions that are being developed and that are available in Canada and elsewhere. It's definitely an evolving area of research because I think that we see THC and we research THC a lot in connection to both positive or beneficial outcomes, but certainly in relation to risks of harm and certain adverse effects or negative health outcomes. CBD is something we're still investigating. We do see some of that medical potential when it comes to what the research is saying, but we also know that it's not without its potential risks. So, certainly for certain populations who may have, again, more heightened vulnerability to cannabis and adverse effects, people who have a history of cannabis use disorder or addiction in their families, people who have mental health conditions in their families, people who might be trying to get pregnant, are pregnant, or breastfeeding, or chest feeding. There's is I would say really still pay attention to CBD and to cannabis products that have other cannabinoids in it, because the reality is we just don't have enough good quality research to know for sure what some of the effects are.
You suggested that cannabis literacy is low, lower than you would like it to be among the Canadian public. What are some of the things you would like there to be more awareness of when it comes to cannabis?
Yeah, I think in general, I think our overall goal in doing research and knowledge mobilization around cannabis, and also in this work around a standard THC unit, is to kind of reduce cannabis-related harms, improve health and well-being and safety of people living in Canada. And a lot of that comes down to helping people make informed decisions about their use that can help them really take control of their own cannabis use. And like you said, boosting that literacy can help people in those informed choices mitigate their risks that are always very individual. It's, we can make all of these recommendations. There's great cannabis lower risk use guidelines that have general recommendations that involve things like delaying your use as long as possible before you begin using cannabis. So for young people, not starting cannabis use until later in life, using lower potency cannabis products, considering the risks of different methods of use. So, smoking comes with different risks, for example, increasing the risk of lung health complications, but also using less cannabis less often. These cannabis use guidelines are great, but they're also general. So people need to be able to make their own personal decisions based on their own risk factors around their cannabis use. And a standard THC unit can really help with that if we're able to help people understand it in a meaningful way and then have it in materials, in guidance materials, and on potentially on labels, so people can make those informed decisions when they're choosing their products and they're choosing how much of it to consume.
Are there any barriers to implementing this? Like, are people worried about, say, the cost of reworking labels, or is there disagreement on what the standard unit should be? Or are there any reasons why anyone wouldn't be on board with the idea of just having a standard unit that is consistent across different products?
I think once we get down to sort of that base concept and definition of it just being a unit of measurement that then we can apply in different ways, that it's not making a claim about being a recommended dose. We're not claiming that it's the same across different formats in terms of its effects, that we're not saying that, one unit equals a moderate high for everyone, for example. I think once people understand the concept of it being a unit of measurement, it kind of reduces some of those barriers, and people are like, oh yeah, this is kind of like a standard drink, and then we can use it in different ways. There certainly are practical barriers that need to be worked out, and that needs to be done in collaboration with a lot of different people. So, the people who come from public health, with government, with retailers and cannabis industry, really talking about how to practically do this on labels or in cannabis spaces. Like you said, there could be some costs associated with it, which I think is sometimes a worry. But there has been regulatory changes made before. For example, they've updated the warning labels on cannabis products so that they are a little bit more product specific. They re-implemented a risk, a warning label related to experiencing symptoms of psychosis. So there's been some changes on labels before. Often, what's recommended when that happens is they just sell out the product that's already on the shelves. And then when they're making the new labels and they're putting new products on the shelf, then it's implemented then. So rather than having to yank products and things like that. So there are ways forward, and it's not a new frontier in terms of changing information on cannabis products, but it does take collaboration and hearing all voices at the table to understand what the real barriers are and then overcoming them together.
This is People First Radio. Shea Wood is a senior knowledge broker at the Canadian Center on Substance Use and Addiction. Right now, we're speaking about the idea of adopting a standard THC unit across Canada. You can think of it as a sort of cannabis equivalent to the idea of a standard drink. Is this a thing that would need to be labeled on specific products in this framing of a standard unit of cannabis? Like, this is 3 standard units of cannabis. I'm thinking of the analogy again to alcohol where, you know, I can understand what a standard drink is in my head, but once in a while I might see a can of something and say, wait a minute, hold on, this is 13.5% alcohol, and it's not like that can says, hey, with a big flashing label, this is actually 2.5 drinks or whatever. So what exactly would you be calling for an actual cannabis product, be it a drink or a joint or a set of gummies, to have on the packaging?
Yeah, this is a really, really good point because we, as I mentioned, the standard drink has been implemented very well in allowing us to do that research. And then also in that research, once you have a large body of research, informing health guidance. However, in Canada, we haven't yet implemented standard drinks on drink labels. So, but other countries have. And so, for example, in the UK, if you pick up a bottle of wine, it'll say how many units of alcohol is in that full bottle. And then they'll have kind of a standard drink glass, like saying, you know, six in the UK, it's 6 ounces of wine equals a standard drink. And there's so many in the bottle. So people are picking up, you know, potentially picking up that that container and making decisions about how much of it they want to drink in order to balance with how much alcohol they want to consume or expose themselves to. Now, here in Canada, we kind of have an opportunity to, I mean, alcohol's been around for so long, and they're sort of now being like, okay, let's think about that and how that might help consumers. For us, we have an opportunity pretty early in the legalization life of this substance to have it on the labels so that consumers can make those informed decisions based on what they see there of how many units, both is in the full product package and in maybe potentially a serving of that product. And it kind of takes you full circle back that once someone then understands, because they've seen it on their package, they've taken a certain amount of that product, and they know how much THC they've consumed, because again, right now, a lot of people don't know how much THC they're consuming. If they knew that, they would better be able to potentially report that on surveys and say, yeah, I use this amount of THC per week or per month. And then we would have better monitoring and research and better understanding of how much THC different people, different communities are being exposed to. So I think that that on the product label isn't, you know, only for people making informed decisions about their use, but it is. But it's also so that they can more, I think, clearly identify and communicate how much THC they're taking in. Because if you think about screening right now, you know, for example, a survey or even a doctor asking, you know, how much cannabis do you use? Often people will talk about frequency of use, right? They'll say, I use once a day, I use once a week, once a month. And someone who uses cannabis in that frequency, they might be using very different amounts of THC. So, you know, the one time I use a day, for example, I take two, you know, hauls off a joint with pretty low potency flower versus using once a day and using a lot of a high potency THC product. Now, that exposure to cannabis, or sorry, to THC is going to be very different in those two individuals. But right now, we're not really able to screen for that as effectively because people aren't even really tracking their own THC consumption and exposure in that way. So that's why having it on labels can actually help to bring it even further past research, past guidance, overall guidance to decision making and reporting.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today on this idea of a standard unit of THC in cannabis?
I think overall, I would just kind of reiterate that overall goal of implementing a standard THC unit is to prevent and reduce cannabis-related harms, improve well-being, health, and safety for people in Canada. And the standard THC unit is a building block for that. It's a unit of measurement that then can support research, education, informed decision-making that can lead to that goal of improved health and well-being. And I think familiarize yourself with the concept. Feel free to go to ccsa.ca to read some of our materials and our reports on it. And in the absence of kind of a widespread THC unit right now, I would really encourage people to look at the lower risk cannabis use guidelines if they use cannabis and they're interested in thinking about that more deeply and potentially, minimizing their risk of having harmful impacts from their cannabis use. There is guidelines and recommendations out there that can help minimize that harm.
Shea Wood, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks, Joe.
Shea Wood is a senior knowledge broker at the Canadian Centre on Substance Use and Addiction. We were speaking there about the idea of adopting a standard THC unit across Canada. We are all but out of time for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. A reminder, you can find past episodes of People First Radio online on our podcast feed. Just search People First Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.